Chapter 4. Crab. As the year pushed on into spring, I realized the pool in the rocks in front of the house was not right. It was too high up the shore and out of the sea for too long between each tide. When I put a thermometer in there at the end of a sunny afternoon, it read almost 60 degrees Fahrenheit, over 15 degrees Celsius. As soon as the tide came in and filled it, the temperature dropped to 40 degrees Fahrenheit, just more than 8 degrees Celsius. That zigzag graph was too much for most life to cope, and for weeks now nothing had come to grow here. The super-tolerant prawns were still in evidence, and the periwinkles were still going about their business, but otherwise it remained a place of rock and water. I would have to start again, further down the tide, and not like this at the head of the bay, but out on one of the headlands, exposed to wind and water, a place in which there was a chance, at least, that life would come to meet me. I walked the mile over to Rua Untasunach. A pair of curlews by the shore were trailing bubbles of music, as Norman McCaig once said of them. Music as desolate, as beautiful as your loved places. They left as I came down to them, and the gulls bounced and beat away crosswind. The point itself is a knuckle of very late Triassic limestone, just older than the rocks at the head of the bay. At the shoreline, this featureless stone is hard, sharp, and intractable, chemically dissolved by seawater into inch-high spicules and hollows, the whole place stripped by the storm waves to a platform on which geese roost and leave their droppings in the rain pools. On a grey day it can be a sombre place. The rock is riven every 30 or 40 yards with dark basalt dikes. At the west end of the headland there was a place that looked right. One of the narrow trenches from which the sea had prized the basalt away opened out into a triangular gap in the limestone, about 30 feet long on each side. At high tides, the sea poured in through the little gateway and filled the triangle to the depth of 3 feet or so. Once the tide withdrew, this pool drained away through the narrow ditch, leaving only a shallow and rather sludgy puddle in the centre of the triangle, in which nothing much occurred. If I could dam the gap, keeping the seawater in the pool, I could make somewhere better than the pool I had dug at the head of the bay, larger, in a more energetic environment, further down the tide. The dam would have to be substantial. The pressures were large, but I was worried that if I built a solid dam it would fill only at the highest of high tides. The pool would be refreshed with new water only twice a month, when spring tides overtopped the wall. Between these moments of renewal, the water would stale. I needed something that would let the sea in at Nepes, but then hold it there. I had seen something like it on the Somerset Levels, one-way exits that opened to allow the rivers to run into the Bristol Channel, but stopping the rising tide coming in to flood the levels themselves. A flap valve. If I could use that in reverse, allow the tide in, not let it out, I had a chance. When I rang Tim Gates, director at Althon, Outfall Engineers of Norwich, he was completing a contract for the rebuilding of Inverness Airport and another for the main drainage system for the city of Doha. I told him something 12 inches wide might do for me. Would I be happy with an Althon 300mm HDPE/SS316L flap valve with square back? He asked. Its hinges were in grade 316L stainless steel, so would not rust for 50 years. I would. For the dam itself, I needed mortar that would cure in the sea. Gilbert Cox, managing director and concrete chemist at Rockbond Special Concretes in Essex, had in the past supplied more than 4,000 tonnes of underwater and tunnelling materials for the Channel Tunnel. I told him my dam was 4 feet long and 3 feet tall, and he thought I could use Rockbond underwater mortar. Maybe 0.3 tons, he said. The mortar had been used to seal and waterproof the walls of the restaurant under the House of Lords. All importantly, it would not contaminate the sea, contain no poisons, and was safe. flap valve and mortar in 25-kilogram bags soon arrived by courier, and I took them across the bay by boat. The dam building began, hard, long and dirty, no machinery, using the rocks from around the pool and plenty of the mortar mixed, bag by bag, in a bucket. The rain never stopped, but it was a kind of happiness, not unlike bread-making, stirring the mortar and seawater to a putty-like consistency, oozy and cakey under my gloved hands, picking up and dumping hummus-like patties of it onto the limestone, rubbing it in, as Gilbert had said, to make a good bond with the surroundings, settling the rocks into its soft and yielding cushions, watching the mortar easing from underneath them in rounded grey Buddha bellies, or like one of those squeezes of stone, the torus at the foot of classical columns. It took 3 days between the tides. I embedded the flap valve in the concrete sludge and built a channel for the water to enter, then a roof for the channel with a big slab on which I could stand. I chose some final rocks for the dam that had channel rack and spiral rack growing on them, and then it was done. I took the boat and all my tools and the empty mortar bags the mile or so back to the head of the bay, where I hauled everything ashore, left it at the top of the beach, dropped into the house, and fell asleep in front of the fire for 9 hours straight. The ebb was to begin the next morning after 10. It was early summer, and the bay was more beautiful than I had ever known it. The light was bouncing up into the wood off the sea. In a place which is so often grey and wet, mornings like this overbrim with colour. Even a distant sail, tipped like a feather on the firth of lawn, looked washed and perfect. The trees were like lettuces, every leaf with the light in it. I had been reading some of Iris Murdoch's early philosophy. "One might start from the assertion that goodness is a form of realism," she wrote, and repeated what Rilke had said of Cézanne. He did not paint, "I like it," he painted, "There it is." Murdoch's governing idea was to look to the real on a day like this, to fuse Rilke's categories. "I like it here in the wood above the sea, because it is here. It is here, and so I like it." In her 1970 masterpiece, The Sovereignty of Good, she wrote of these occasions of unselfing. "I am looking out of my window in an anxious and resentful state of mind, oblivious of my surroundings, brooding perhaps on some damage done to my prestige. Then, suddenly, I observe a hovering kestrel. In a moment, everything is altered. The brooding self with its hurt vanity has disappeared. There is nothing now but kestrel. And when I return to thinking of the other matter, it seems less important. And of course, this is something which we may also do deliberately, give attention to nature in order to clear our minds of selfish care." It is not that nature itself is valuable. There is no more value in it than there is in us. But the opportunity it provides to amend our consciousness, to remove the unending claims of the self, to deny the primacy of the self as anything more than a ripple in the general flux of the world, is a moment of education in what she called the intolerably chancy and incomplete nature of being. We take a self-forgetful pleasure in the sheer, alien, pointless, independent existence of animals, birds, stones and trees, she wrote, and then repeated, without attribution, her version of Wittgenstein's great saying, "Not how the world is, but that it is the mystical." The self, the place where we live, is a place of illusion. Goodness is connected with the attempt to see the unself, to see and to respond to the real world in the light of a virtuous consciousness. This is the non-metaphysical meaning of the idea of transcendence. Virtue is the attempt to pierce the veil of selfish consciousness and join the world as it really is. Diminish the self. Feel the reality of things, accept the facts of mutability, including the fact of death, Allow the other a valid and vivid place in your mind. Do not think of the self as a dam against the flux, but allow the flux to flood through you. See beauty in the realities of the world, the quivering of the kestrel, the blurring of the tide, and in the wake of that, a kind of happiness, the happiness that comes not from absence or self-abnegation, but from openness, from seeing existence as a pool into which the sea can come and go, has a chance of flooding in. Love, Iris Murdoch once said, in the tenderest, gentlest, and most honest sentence she ever wrote, is the extremely difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. I was down at Rua Untasunach as the tide was starting to pull away. I could see the dam I had made still afoot under water, its rocks liquid and out of focus with the movement of the sea over them. The flap valve was opening and closing as the pressure of each new wave pushed at it and withdrew. Half an hour to wait, watching for the leaving of the tide. A gannet was fishing in the bay, in from St. Kilda, down the sound to the castle and back up again, cruising half a mile a minute, beating to windward, then seeing something, turning and sweeping down before climbing again. Then its dive, which it began and partway through pulled out, the fish gone, a dive interruptus. Now only the glitter of the sea beneath it, as it flew off away to the west, joined by another, both searching, nothing perfect. It was 10:26 in the morning, and the bay was turning stony as the ebb pulled eastwards. The ochre orange of the wrack started to coat the fringes of the shore. Above it, a band of the black Verrucana lichen, which tolerates salt spray but not regular immersion. Above that, the white of the limestone speckled with the green and pink buttons of thrift, and above that, among the grasses and the eggs and bacon vetch, the pink wind-torn petals of ragged robin. It is a world of layered niches in which the vertical gradations are fine, these changes occurring in steps above the sea, no more than 9 or 10 inches high. 10:42. The tide drops and the water is now only 3 inches above the top of the dam. 10:46. As the flow steepens, the sea rolls out over the dam in a smooth shampoo curl across its upper rocks, the whole structure under it bellying and shifting in the lens of the ebb. 10:48. One of the rocks in the dam comes out of the water for the first time. 10:54. The broken surface of the sea means that its level changes with every wave, and I cannot judge if the dam is holding. 10:57. At last, and still only intermittently, the calm of the pool starts to grow like the closing of an eye. Outside, all is chop and motion. Inside, momentarily, stability, the still stand. The pressure difference between the two is now holding the flap valve shut tight. 11:01. The sea has dropped away, and the pool lies in its cup of rock, clear and perfect. The wind makes a slight ripple across its surface. The dam is holding. The enclosure felt huge. I could look down into it from the little cliff on the south side, as if into a giant aquarium, about 2,500 litres of sea held in there, 2.5 tons of water. Some of the creatures that had previously been surviving in the small puddle in the centre now found themselves at home in the deepest part of the pool. My friend Tom Hammock came for a day or two, and with long steels we manoeuvred rocks into those deeps to make shade and shelter for the animals. When I put my head in, or dipped an underwater camera in there, I met a parkland of beauty, a sudden access to the world as it really is. Beadlet anemones, some of them bright, new blood red when seen against the wavering sunlight, others auburn and copper, the colour of my daughter Molly's hair, all in the pale filter of the clean water, with winkles and prawns around them, a common goby, and a narrow, elegant fish half hidden inside a sprig of weed, hanging there 2.5 inches long, a sharp snout, the tail unseen, a gilded eye with grey mottled top and pale yellowish underside, not making a move, a 15-spine stickleback waiting in the way that predators wait. I watched a tall green parasol-ribbed limpet making its slow way across one of the boulders that Tom and I had put in there, dragging its track through the biofilm and leaving in its wake a dark line of the clean-down basalt, the mark of a steady and purposeful morning in which it had gardened its rock, farmed its country, and understood its world, mowing the meadow in the laborious, careful way of those who are attached to their places. I soon saw that this was to be a crab pool, their own little theatre in which the dramas of crab life could be played out. There are many different sorts of crab in the bay, and in creels I have caught them all, the pie-crusted lid of the edible or brown crab, the pink of the swimmers, the dark furred mystery of the velvets. Those are largely found away from the shore, but here this pool was now to be the stalking ground and manor of the green shore crab, Carcinus minas, whose Latin name sounds as if it describes its maleficence, but only signifies that it likes to eat a little fish, a mina, now and then. The French call it le crabe enragé, from its habit of approaching in fury with open claws held aloft. I put a small crab trap in there, baited with bacon. Within a few minutes a green crab was manoeuvring towards it, from about 4 yards away, the smell communicated through the water. It was big, about 3 inches across, and walked directly towards the trap, and then up over its netting, soon finding the inward-reaching cone-shaped mouth that led towards the bacon. The crab paused there for a good minute, as if questioning the idea of entering this strange, food-rich, unaccustomed place. Was it a trap? The smell of bacon must have overcome the wariness, and it pushed further in. 6 minutes after I had first seen it moving, the crab had fallen down into the trap's belly, where it would get to the bacon, but from which there was no escape. As it started to touch and hold the bait, 2 other crabs could be seen approaching from the far side of the pool. The first went past the entrance and in under the trap to the point where it was next to the crab that was already in there. The 2 of them began to grapple with each other through the net, one with access to the food but trapped, the other with no bacon but free. The 3rd, a little pale green one, bundled itself fast across the floor of the pool, climbing and semi-buoyant, with slightly less than neutral buoyancy, looking as if it had about as much gravity in water as an astronaut on the moon. Without pause, a fool rushing in, it flipped down into the trap already occupied by its bigger rival, which now looked suddenly enormous. Perceiving the entrance of the small, pale crab, the older one neglected its rival outside and turned towards the newcomer. Young crabs are all green, but old ones, or at least crabs which have not molted for a long time, are flushed red, particularly in the joints of their legs and claws. This beautiful old thing had a grey-green carapace, black at the front and with pale, almost moth-like patterning on its lid, white constellations of dots fanned out like the eyes on a peacock tail. Carefully it stirred its bronzy legs, each joint glowing orange like a set of eyes, and greeted the intruder. The drama lasted a few minutes. The little crab retreated to a corner and held its pitiable, pale, lime-green claws up towards the enemy. For a moment the big crab picked up the little one in a claw and walked back sideways with it, crab-wise, down into the depths of the trap, past the bacon, to a point at the far end where the little crab was held there in its attacker's pincers, delicately, as if it were a teacup in a pair of fingers and thumbs, while the young crab's legs flicked and stirred at its undoing. I waded in and collected the trap, released both big and little big crab, and watched the 3rd walk away, quickly, past the ochre anemones, heading for the shade of the south wall and a protective stand of bladder wrack. It does not take much to see that these animals are brutally successful, efficient and voracious, eating worms, other crustaceans, including their own conspecifics, and many mollusks. They will dominate and transform any coast they find. as aggressive, opportunistic predators with the ability to tolerate wide extremes of heat, salinity, and even drought, they have been carried inadvertently in the holds of ships across much of the world, and are now a destructive and alien threat in Japan, Australia and Tasmania, South Africa, Argentina, and both coasts of North America, from Newfoundland to Virginia and California to British Columbia. Their only enemy is warm water, and although they have often been found there, they have yet to colonize the tropics. There is something in us which dislikes the successful and prefers the rare and endangered, but you have to admire the chutzpah of the green crab. In October 1991, Dr. J.P. O'Connor of the National Museum of Ireland was telephoned by Dublin's environmental health inspectors to be told that some crab-like creatures were infesting a domestic premises in Dublin City. The owner of the house, an elderly lady, had complained to the health board that something wicked was emerging from the drains and besieging her. They had crawled about on the floors of the kitchen and the living room. She was frightened and had killed one of them with a telephone book. The same creatures had entered the house on two previous occasions, but the lady had been too ashamed to report these incidents to the health board. Inspectors arrived and found dead green crabs outside the house on the pavements of Manor Street, more than 2 miles from Dublin Bay, and about 800 yards uphill from the River Liffey, where it flows through the city. Dr. O'Connor was then informed of another green crab that had been lost somewhere in the city, only to be rediscovered 42 days later in a damp garage. When found, Dr. O'Connor reported, the crab, a fully grown male, was dusty and thrust out its claws aggressively. It recovered fully from its experience and was returned to the sea. The adventurousness and adaptability of Carcinus minas may explain its world-straddling success, but it is far from cavalier. These crabs approach life with impressive displays of delicacy and discrimination, clearly recognizing that only by looking after themselves will they survive. One might imagine that the most economic of crab strategies is to find the biggest mussels and crack them open for food. That is largely the human approach to eating other animals, but it turns out that in common with other shell-focused predators, such as oyster catchers, which usually choose to open the smaller-than-average cockles, wanting to protect their bills from harm, that is not the case. Nature is not red in tooth and claw, but a constant and careful evaluation of the risk-reward ratios in every transaction. The greedy die young, accountants get rich. The two claws of green crabs are of different sizes, the bigger one a crusher, the smaller a cutter. Usually, when presented with a small or average-sized mussel, the minor claw steadies the shell while the crusher does the work. With bigger mussels, whose shells are too strong to crush, the crab changes tactic and uses the smaller claw to snip along the leading edges of the mussel, where the two halves of its shell meet, and get access that way. There seems to be a universal rule of thumb which shore crabs follow. If the width of the mussel is more than a quarter the length of the crab's crushing claw, the crab will be forced to cut its edges rather than crush the whole animal. But cutting is not popular. The Dutch biologists Isabel M. Smalahanger and Jaap van der Meer investigated the eating habits of green crabs on the western coast of Texel, at the southern end of the Frisian Islands in the North Sea, and found, first, that the crabs much preferred crunching to snipping, probably because it was quicker, and secondly, that the mussels they decided to crunch were always well below the horizon at which crushing would not work. It would seem, Smalahanger and van der Meer wrote, that crabs prefer to crush in the safe zone to prevent damage and wear to the claws. Instinctive calculation, a capacity to measure, a sense of proportion in the relationship of muscle width to claw length, and the understanding that life needs to continue beyond the attractions of the immediate moment, all of this is in the mind of Carcinus minas. After a few days, entranced by the life in the new pool, looking into all its corners, finding the refuges of the crabs, the gatherings of anemones, I came across a huge and beautiful mussel, which had clearly lived a long time in the edge of the pool, perhaps in one of the minor folds in the rock which had held some water before I had made my dam. It was well settled in, too defended and too much of a prospect for any crab to nail. It sat handsomely in its tight corner, near an anemone, encrusted and ancient, rimmed in coralline, and with a leaf of channel rack on its shell, the bivalves just open, showing its inner body, like lips just apart, filtering the water for microscopic food, living a rich old Miss Havisham life, which no crab could disturb. It was the only mussel I could find in the pool. There was a total absence of smaller mussels around it. I could only guess at its age. Mussels stop growing when they are about 6 years old, but individuals can survive until they are about 12, as I'm sure this one had. But it was clear that if this old mussel matriarch was producing offspring, the crabs must have been dealing with them one by one as soon as they came to life. This reduction in mussel abundance was the product of an arms race. The toughening and enlarging of the mussel was up against the toughening and enlarging of the crabs that were out to kill and eat it. As with the winkles, the only way of winning the race was to escape predation until you were too big to kill, or at least so big that killing you would cost too much in time, risk, and effort. At the same time, a full-on arms race is also underway within the population of the crabs themselves. Claws are the necessary instruments not only for eating, but for establishing a crab's place in its world. Meet a green crab with your fingers, and it will fling both claws out above it and to each side, holding them high above its face with pincers apart, as much like a stag and its antlers as any marine creature. It becomes, in an instant, le crabe enragé. Male crabs fight hard over access to females, and at those moments a big pair of claws is a better predictor of breeding success than a big body. But there are subtleties here. When a claw is damaged, the crab has the ability to sever it from its own body, a form of self-amputation known as autotomy, after which a new claw grows in its place, if only slowly and over the subsequent one or two molts. When the crab is old, it loses completely the capacity to replace the missing limb. The Norwegian ecologist Gro Sekkelsten investigated the effect of missing claws on the mating success of green crabs, with an intriguing result. Among young small males, those with a missing claw were no less successful in mating than those with both claws, not because missing a claw did not matter, but because small young crabs had little success in mating, clawed or not. The handicap did not materially affect the outcome. Little male crabs do not, on the whole, win in the battle for mates. In medium-sized males, the negative effects of clawlessness were obvious. Properly clawed-up males found mates and were able to breed with them. Males with only one claw or none were left mateless. There was a third stage, when among the largest, oldest males, it is impossible to age a crab, but they also might live until they are 9 or 10, the negative effect of losing a claw was again small, but for a reason opposite to the failures of the smallest crabs. Big males, two-clawed or not, were just as able, literally, to grab and hold a female as normal males. Once in their possession, they were able to mate with them. Age and strength, even if you carry the scars of ancient battles, are the route to sexual success in the world of the green crab. In the pool on Rua and Tasunach, looking in there one summer morning, when the air over the sound and the water in the pool were of equal stillness and clarity, Sarah saw just beneath the little southern cliff a big green crab holding a smaller one in its arms. We had never seen such a thing before. It looked like a heraldic emblem, an escutcheon demonstrating the facts of dominance. But this was not another killing. It was the very opposite. The protection by a big male of a pre-molting female, in preparation for crab sex. The whole phenomenon is dependent on the life choice represented by a shell. The crustacea have found armour as their principal means of defence, but armour makes sex difficult, if not impossible, and female crabs are receptive to the male only after they have molted their old shell and for the day or two until it hardens again. They must be soft to have sex. In the crab-eat-crab world of the pool, that moment of procreation is filled with danger, and so the male gathers her up, even before she has molted, into what is called a pre-copulatory embrace. That is what, entrancingly, we had seen in the pool. Big male with smaller female held in his arms, protecting her from other crabs that might have wanted to eat her in her softness, while also guaranteeing that he was the sole male parent of the brood she would bear. The timetable is not rushed. In aquarium experiments, there was a lag of up to 20 days between the first introduction of male and female crab and the male scooping her into his arms. She sends out pheromone signals to him in her urine, suggesting this might be a good idea, and in some experiments she walks towards the male and touches him with one of her claws, repeating the gesture many times. Some biologists have seen, very occasionally, at this tender moment, the male crab eating the outstretched claw of the female, to which she responded by continuing to stroke and touch him with her other, single, remaining claw. It was thought, maybe, by the Floridian scientist who observed this horror, that the male crab was immature and did not understand the offer the female was making to him. Such a catastrophic outcome is not usual, though, and once she is in position, he carries her around, holding her with one of his walking legs against the underside of his abdomen, the female cooperating by not resisting and by keeping her walking legs and claws at least partly folded. They are both the same way up, her back pressing against his abdomen. This holding while walking can go on for more than 2 weeks, but usually lasts less than half that. He is perfectly able at this point to fight off other males who come too close. Finally, she molts underneath him, and copulation begins soon afterwards, him helping to turn her carefully over so that they meet abdomen to abdomen, folding out the abdominal underflaps so that he can insert his copulatory stylets into the female's paired vulvae, while she hangs on to him with the tips of her legs for 2 or 3 days until copulation is over. Afterwards, she turns the right way up again and they embrace, staying like that for 2 or 3 further days before separating and moving off to their different places in the pool. Is this not unlike anything you might have imagined for a crab? The patience and delicacy of it, the reality of communication between the sexes, the sense of choice that is implicit in every one of their steady and careful moves. I knew from a later study by Gro Sekelsten that green crabs were deliberate and careful shapers of their submarine world. Once a week over 2 summers, on the rough and stony beaches of the island of Herdla, about 20 miles north of Bergen, she snorkelled across an area of nearly 4 acres, just offshore, looking to see how the green crabs were behaving. In a small part of that area, she found that the crabs had established a mating ground, which she visited every day, following their lives by marking them with wax crayons and by, painlessly, branding numbers onto the carapaces with a soldering iron. This mating ground was, objectively, nothing special, with no particular resources nor any protection against bird or fish predators, but it did occupy a striking geographical position at the tip of a small headland in the very centre of a bay, between that headland and an off-lying skerry. It was not unlike the places where the chieftains of medieval Argyll chose to locate their castles and display halls, crowning spots which could be recognised as hinge locations in that part of the sea. A site of male prominence, dominance, violence and theatrical display is exactly what Gro Sekelsten discovered in the green crab's mating ground. It became what she called a hot spot. The big, old, powerful male crabs gathered there, and females knew that was where they could find them. As a crab shell ages between each molt, it moves over from green to yellowish, orange, and finally red, not equally over the whole surface of the shell, but in a beautiful mottling, as if each stage in a crab's life had within it a spring, summer, and autumn, finally reddening like a maple leaf before the shell is cast. When young, they can molt several times a year, the body enlarging by something like 20% each time. As they age, the rhythm slows, and by the time they are 6 or 7, they have ceased to molt at all and have settled on growing old in their skins, putting more energy into reproductive strength than the growth of their own body. These old breeder males are the end point of that process, bigger, redder, more aggressive, with a larger master claw and a thicker carapace than all the others. They are also, in the way of grand old autarchs, rather touchy and set in their ways, less able to tolerate changes in temperature, salinity and oxygen content in the seawater than their younger, slighter and greener rivals. Female crabs were not usually found in the hot spot, but were discreetly dispersed around the coast. They came to the mating ground only when they were ready, visiting it to seek out one of the big old males. The competition between those old males was violent and ferocious, a life struggle to get hold of the visiting sex-ready females. Young, agile little males had no chance of fighting their way in there. The group of dominant old reds monopolized the visitors, choosing mates freely, taking over a female from subordinate males without much cost, as Dr. Seckelstein observed, and fertilizing them one after another as they arrived at the tip of the peninsula. Sequential polygyny was the prerogative of a dominant male, and the group of them dictated conditions in the hot spot, each remaining in his particular zone within the patch. What is a young male crab to do? They can achieve little reproductive success by competing for mates in the same way as those reds, and so should they not compete at all and invest instead in growth rather than in endless failed attempts at reproduction? Did they have to wait and, as Gros Eckelstein expressed it, run the risk of not living long enough to reach dominant size? Even when death was ever present and postponing sex might mean never having sex at all? Those questions are real for young male green crabs, and they have an answer. Don't confront the big old tyrants, but sneak in where you can. All around the peninsula on Herdla, Seckelsten observed a positively Shakespearean set of dramas unfolding. The old despots found the softening, pheromone-broadcasting females coming up to them in their hotspot territories as if it were their due. The female crabs were choosing to come not to the big crabs themselves, but to the mating ground where fierce competition guaranteed that only the strongest could survive there. It was a way of using geography to ensure high-quality progeny. If a small male tried to grab one of the females in the hot spot, he would always have her snatched away from him by an old male. Nevertheless, in the suburbs of that mating ground, small young males would roam or even wait in hiding, hoping to ambush the pre-molting females, making their way to the big crabs at the tip of the peninsula. Unseen by the big reds, the young Turks could occasionally get away with it. The anxiety can only have been enormous, and once they had collared their pre-molt female, the young crabs made sure to take them somewhere safe. All small crabs were found mating in places almost inaccessible for the largest males and distant from the mating ground, where whatever gratification a crab can have was not in power-driven establishment copulation, but in secret, no doubt fear-filled trysts hidden among the rocks. I am not sure yet, because it is early days and these geographical patterns may take time to develop, but I hope that the pool on Rua and Tasunach might become one such hotspot. Certainly, at least one big green going on yellow, orange and red crab had taken up position there, and a pre-breeding female had found him and offered herself to be gathered up in the protective hold of his pre-copulatory embrace, from which future generations will no doubt emerge. In the late 18th century, as the imperial enterprise of the European states spread out across the world oceans, the scientists accompanying the naval expeditions started to examine the creatures of the deep. As John Vaughan Thompson, the great hidden hero of these studies, wrote in 1828, strange and unknown creatures had been found. Professor Slaber, in a Dutch work entitled Natural Amusements and Microscopical Observations, published at Haarlem in 1778, has given us a description and figure of the species which has been since designated Zoea taurus. Bosque, one of the most judicious naturalists of the French school, in a voyage which he undertook to America with a view to natural history, discovered a single individual in the Atlantic Ocean, 500 or 600 leagues from the coast of France, and, justly conceiving it distinct from all the other genera, first instituted that of Zoea for the reception of these anomalous animals. Mr. Crunch, in the course of Captain Tucky's voyage to the Congo, discovered the curious and singular species which Dr. Leach has named Zoea clavata, from the club-like shape of its dorsal and lateral spines. These Zoeae, meaning living things, by which Slaber, Bosque, Crunch and Leach were so intrigued, were a class of animal which would not receive their collective name until almost a century later. The plankton, meaning the floaters or wanderers, those creatures which did not seem to move with any direction given by themselves. Thompson himself had been born to an English family in New York in 1779, but the family soon removed to England after the loss of the American colonies, and Thompson was educated as a doctor in Edinburgh. He became an army surgeon in the Caribbean and Mauritius, and in his spare time made careful studies of plants and birds. In 1816, he returned on half pay from Mauritius to York, the port city on the south coast of Ireland. On the long voyage, the luminosity or sparkling of the sea by night entranced him. The sea was full of those glittering presences, and his focus turned to the more minute and invisible inmates of the sea. Wherever he was, Thompson would always throw out astern a small towing net of gauze, bunting, or other tolerably close material, occasionally drawing it up and turning it inside out into a glass vessel of seawater to ascertain what captures have been made. It was a plankton net, and Thompson is the first person known to have used one regularly. This towing for luminous animals had discovered strange beings. They seemed to be related to shrimps, prawns, or crayfish, but as Thompson wrote, it was no matter of surprise that all the leading naturalists of the present day should have been at a loss how to dispose of Zoea in their arrangements of the crustacea. The breakthrough came in 1822. Thompson, now married to his Irish wife Martha, and with the first of their 6 children born, to his great surprise, found Zoeas in the harbour of Cove, and that in considerable abundance. The following year, when he threw out a small muslin towing net on crossing the Ferryat Passage, such a capture of minute animals was made as furnished a treat which few can ever expect to meet, and could hardly be excelled for the variety, rarity, and interesting nature of the animals taken. Some of them never before met with, but in the great ocean, others previously seen by a solitary observer, and almost lost sight of by naturalists, and excluded from their works. Among them was a particularly large Zoea, and Thompson managed to keep it alive in a jar of constantly refreshed seawater from the 14th of May until the 15th of June. when it died in the act of changing its skin and of passing into a new form, but one by no means similar to that expected, as appears evidently by its disengaged members, which are changed in number as well as in form, and now correspond with those of the decapoda, crabs, etc., viz. 5 pair, the anterior of them furnished with a large claw or pincer. No one until that moment in Thomson's study in Cork had imagined that a crustacean could undergo metamorphosis. Insects were known to go through various distinct stages of grub and pupa before emergence as an adult, but it was the accepted wisdom that the lack of metamorphosis was what distinguished crustaceans from the insects. 4 years later, the final link was made. In the waters of the cove, Thomson had caught an edible crab that was buried, or thick with clustered eggs, stored on its abdomen. He removed some of the eggs and kept them in an ever-refreshed jar of seawater. One or two of them soon hatched, and presented exactly the appearance of Zoea taurus, the bull-horned life thing found and named 50 years before by Professor Slapper. Thomson was justifiably excited at what he had seen. The crustacea decapita, then, indisputably undergo a metamorphosis, a fact which will form an epoch in the history of this generally neglected tribe, and tend to create an interest which may operate favourably in directing more of the attention of naturalists towards them. He had found that crustaceans undergo metamorphosis, that the distinction between the crustacea and the insecta was invalid, and the strange presence of Zoeae in the ocean had been explained. A year later, in 1828, he published a paper announcing his discoveries with the appropriate punctuation on the metamorphoses of the crustacea and on Zoeae, exposing their singular structure and demonstrating that they are not, as has been supposed, a peculiar genus, but the larva of crustacea. 2! No one believed him. The biological establishment in Britain and Europe pooh-poohed the revelations from Cork. The Zoological Journal cast aspersions on his methods. In 1835, J. O. Westwood, secretary of the London Entomological Society, published a paper in the Journal of the Royal Society on the supposed existence of metamorphoses in the crustacea, which rubbished Thomson's discoveries. It is the received opinion among naturalists that the crustacea do not undergo metamorphoses, properly so called, and that the transformations they exhibit consist merely in the periodical shedding of the outer envelope, and hinted obliquely at fraud, referring to Thomson's supposed Zoeae and supposed metamorphoses. French and German biologists, including the great Prussian Heinrich Rathke, thought crustacean metamorphosis impossible. Rathke had witnessed young crayfish that had emerged from the egg, microscopically small but indistinguishable in form from the adults. If crayfish were born as recognisable, why not crabs? It was a brutal and painful exclusion, inescapably reminiscent of the big clawed reds in their hot spot and the little greens dancing hopefully around the edges. Thomson was right and the grandees wrong, but he was poor, publishing privately in Cork, and they rich, with all the resources and influence behind them of the great scientific institutions in London, Berlin, and Paris. Nevertheless, heroically, he persisted. On the 1st of May 1826, he collected in his net a small translucent animal, 1/10 of an inch long, of a somewhat elliptic form. When in a state of perfect repose, it resembles a very minute mussel and lies upon one of its sides at the bottom of the vessel of seawater in which it is placed. At this time, all the members of the animal are withdrawn within the shell. Thomson had no idea what his creature was, but as an experimental scientist, with his discoveries in mind of metamorphosis in the crabs, he was prepared to watch. he put these tiny withdrawn ellipses in a glass vessel covered by such a depth of seawater that they could be examined at any time by means of a common magnifying glass. At night, a week later, the author had the satisfaction to find that two of them had thrown off their exuvia and, wonderful to say, were firmly adhering to the bottom of the vessel and changed into young barnacles, such as are usually seen intermixed with grown specimens on rocks and stones at this season of the year. As the larval swimming form of the barnacle metamorphosed into its fixed and sessile state, it lost its eyes and began to build around it the calcareous plates that would protect it for the rest of its life. Thomson had made a second discovery as amazing as the realization that the zoeae were young crabs. Until then, everyone had assumed that barnacles were relatives of limpets. Thomson had seen they were closer to prawns. Thus, then, an animal originally nictitatory and locomotive, and provided with a distinct organ of sight, becomes permanently and immovably fixed, and its optic apparatus obliterated, and furnishes not only a new and important physiological fact, but is the only instance in nature of so extraordinary a metamorphosis. The zoological establishment was again slow to accept his findings. Not until the 1850s was Thomson's genius recognised, when Charles Darwin, by then the king of barnacle studies, called Vaughan Thomson's work a capital discovery. Rathke, Westwood and the others all came round in the end, but too late for Thomson to feel celebrated or even vindicated. Martha Thomson had died in 1832, and dismayed at the reception of his discoveries, her husband was left alone with six young children and shrinking funds. He wrote to the treasurer of the Linnaean Society in London, describing the pecuniary loss sustained by the publication of my zoological researches and the great expense incurred by the prosecution of those discoveries by being obliged to keep up an establishment on the seaside during a great part of the period and the disbursements consequent on boat hire travelling back and forward. It could not continue, and in June 1835 he took a desperate new position in Australia as chief medical officer to the army and to the convicts in New South Wales, as bleak an occupation as could then be imagined. A portrait was made of him, wearing the handsome and epauletted uniform of the army medical man, but in whose eyes and pursed mouth it is just possible to detect the sensitive, clever, bruised figure he had become. Communicating with the scientific community in Europe was not easy. Isolated and disappointed, Thomson died at home in Sydney in 1847, aged 67. This great and pitiable man was buried in the city 2 days later. But when, in 1901, Sydney Central Railway Station needed an extension, Thomson's grave and its stone were both destroyed. There is something unworldly about the mathematics of marine generation. Female green crabs can breed two or three times a year, carefully keeping the male spermatophores in copulatory pouches, where the sperm remains viable for 4 or 5 months, until the time has come to fertilise the eggs. Each time they will carry up to 185,000 of them. If they breed for 5 years, each female crab will produce almost 3 million fertilised offspring. They are not like us, but they are scarcely in the race when it comes to other sea organisms. A single oyster can broadcast between 15 and 115 million young into the seas around it. Starfish pump out 200 million spermatozoa each breeding season, and the predators are waiting. Every day, a large mussel can filter feed on up to 100,000 larvae of various creatures. So many progeny, so few survivors. In a ratio of making to living that seems almost mad, not like the fine-tuning of natural selection, but a blanketing of the sea space, proposing almost infinite numbers of candidates for life, for each of which the chances of individual survival are within 1 or 2 microns of zero. And yet the fine-tuning is there. Unknown to Thomson, and not fully realised until the 1990s, the early life of a green crab is meticulously fitted to its world. First, while the eggs remain attached to the female, the embryos within, waiting until they have grown to a point where they can survive independently, become entrained, both habituated to and familiar with the comings and goings of the tide. Perhaps through changes in water pressure that rises at high tide and drops with the ebb, a tidal consciousness is embedded in them by which they will govern much of the rest of their lives. These tidal clocks are set in phase with local tides before zoeae are released. Microscopic animals learn to grasp the essential pattern of their world. The mother is equally aware, and controlling release of the eggs, she ensures that the newly hatched zoeae emerge into the water at the very moment of a night-time high tide, the dark still stand when the ebb will begin to flow and draw the tens of thousands of young vulnerable creatures away from the shore and out into the deeper sea. Crab larvae have been found in one of these early planktonic phases, 30 miles or more out from the coast, protected by the scale and volume of the sea, which is not a salt desert, but a giant refuge where tiny vulnerable beings can hide in its immensity. They do not get there by chance. In the summer of 1994, the Chinese crustacean zoologist Chao Shu Zeng was researching his doctorate at the School of Ocean Sciences in North Wales. He collected the zoeae of Carcinus minas with a plankton net in a series of slow 2.5-knot tows behind a small boat in a sheltered bay at the mouth of the Menai Strait. Looking after them as carefully as he could, he put them into a set of little Perspex aquariums, each tank 15 inches high, 6 wide, and 2 inches from front to back. They were made that narrow to isolate a particular form of behaviour and fitted with 2 infrared beams, one at the bottom and one at the top. Zeng filled them with seawater and populated them with zoeae. A computer recorded every time a zoea crossed a beam. This beautiful experiment, for which the Zoological Society of London gave Dr. Zeng their Thomas Henry Huxley Award for original contributions to zoology, revealed something that had never been shown before. The crab larvae swam up and down the tank at completely predictable intervals of 12 hours and 25 minutes. These vertical journeys were timed so that the larvae were at the top just after high tide and at the bottom just after low tide. The larvae, in other words, swam up into the ebb tide so that they would be carried out to sea and down below the levels at which there was any appreciable tidal flow when the tide set the other way and would have carried them in towards the shore. This endogenously controlled tidal vertical migration means that the young crabs are preferentially transported seaward. They use the tide to go out to sea in order to grow in safety. The larvae are released into an independent existence at early stage of development and do not yet have all the body segments and appendages an adult crustacean needs for life on the shore. During their life out at sea, they gradually and successfully add new body parts and limbs until the required number is reached. As it makes its way towards adulthood, the young crab goes through 4 of these zoeal stages, each lasting up to a week, until, in the end, in its final larval transformation, it turns into what has clearly become a proto-crab, still only an eighth or a quarter of an inch long, but without the defensive spike on its back, and now called a megalops, meaning big eye, as it has acquired proportionately enormous eyes, alongside a full complement of legs, claws, maxillipeds, antennae and tail. Here Dr. Zeng made his second great and connected discovery. He had revealed how the young zoeae escape offshore. How did Megalops return to begin the shore-based life of the green crabs you can find under any stone on nearly any beach in Europe and, increasingly, the temperate world? Zeng trawled for the Megalopses and found them crowding in towards the shore at night, towards the end of the flood tide, and within a day or two of their final metamorphosis. They had clearly swum up into a flood tide which had brought them inshore, but the situation was complicated. The Zoeae had simply used the ebb tide as a conveyor belt to take them away from the land. The Megalopses, when they were in the laboratory aquariums, swam to the surface at times that coincided with both the ebb and the flood. Why was that? If they needed to use the flood tide to come ashore, why not stay down at the bottom during the ebb? Zeng's answer implied a subtle net of ideas in the mind of the young animals. They would have sensed they were within a few days of metamorphosing into a true crab. Everyone he caught was approaching that change. They would know that, notwithstanding the advantages of flood-tide swimming in bringing them inshore, such swimming would also put them at considerable risk of premature stranding into tidally if metamorphosis was not imminent. His theory was that two processes were at work. The Megalopses retained from the zoeal stages the instinct to swim in the ebb. They had also developed a desire to come inshore on the flood. For a brief and critical period in their lives, the two instincts were in balance. They would live just offshore, even in the surf zone, until the moment they were about to molt and become true crabs, and then they could choose to come ashore on the high tide swept in by the sea, arriving at the beach as they had chosen, just at high tide mark, where they would molt and, as shore crabs, still only a few millimetres across, begin the rest of their lives. It is not hard to repeat what Dr. Zeng had done. Most of the plankton in the sea by early summer are different forms of crustacea, and they bloom each year from early June on into July and August, feeding on the vegetable or phytoplankton that erupted in the spring. Now, in summer evenings, the animal or zooplankton make a vertical migration into the surface waters. There, with the fine mesh muslin net trailed behind a slowly rowed boat and a small jar tied to its tail end, I fished for some before carefully decanting their seawater into lidded jars. I brought the gathered seawater back to my microscope, and in the eyepieces in front of me found a set of beings which looked as if they came from another world. The sudden recognition of forms, some like a length of data or computer code, others spiral, a chromosome of light and dark, repeating around their twisted cycles, like the heavy springs from the suspension of a car, but all too small to be seen with the naked eye. Some like small translucent glass animals, others with horns and spikes, protected by their lances both fore and aft, and every one of them an instrument of almost unnecessary precision. As if the smaller the animal, the less sleek it could be, the more openly laboratory-made, unlike the sheeny cosmetic and hermetic enclosing skin, say, of a mackerel or a salmon. The world in the microscope looked like a world without skin. These millions of beings which flood the bay each year at such enormous expense to their parents and themselves have no need of sleekness. They are the ingredients of the unseen soup of life. Pure vertigo, limitlessness beneath my feet, looking down into this other universe. I tried at first to examine them without killing them, but it was no good. They zipped away from the eyepiece of the microscope at speeds for which the level of magnification made it impossible to track them. I had no industrial alcohol, and so they were embalmed for my studies in 1/8 of an inch of Finnish vodka, whose fumes came sifting up past me as I peered into their remoteness and complexity. They floated below me in a kind of inner space, the imagined creatures of a vodka cosmos. Among them was the Megalops of a green shore crab. in reality about one-third of a millimetre across, just visible to the naked eye, but in the microscope revealed in its magnificent strangeness, vast-eyed, frail-limbed, spiculed, green but semi-transparent, its organs visible within its shell, the claws of the adult already in evidence, an organism on the verge of life ashore. After I had made my attempts at photographing them with a camera that slotted into one of the eyepieces of the microscope, the least I felt I could do was to drink the vodka, a little salty with its admixture of seawater, mildly proteinaceous with the infant animals it contained. A plankton shot, the cocktail of life.